The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this June 17th, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We're on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher and other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we're doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking during these interesting days. Today is a welcome relief. It's all comedy, all humor for the hour. At least the book is all comedy and all humor. I'm here for the full hour with Carrie Leiser. Carrie is the creator of the award-winning show, The New Adventures of Old Christine, which was based on her life as a single working mom and an Emmy-nominated co-executive producer for Will and Grace. Her debut novel is Aren't You Forgetting Someone? Essays from My Midlife Revenge. Carrie joins me from her sometimes empty nest home in Vermont that she shares with her chickens, her dogs, her cats, her horses, and occasionally her children. Carrie, welcome.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, first off, thank you. I felt like I've almost forgotten how to laugh. It felt, I forgot how good it feels to laugh. So thank you. That was, This was a welcome comic relief. And, you know, it's funny because I almost feel like, especially in the last couple of weeks, kind of don't even have permission to laugh anymore. And so, I don't know. It was just a good release valve. I don't know if you had the prescience. I know you started putting this book together at the beginning of this administration's term.
Yes.
So perhaps you knew we were going to need this.
Well, I mean, as a comedy writer, even before this book, I think that's always on my mind, and it's always why I feel grateful to do what I do, because there always been rough patches, and I have always had the good fortune to go to work and laugh during those rough patches. You know, I was on Will and Grace when 9/11 happened, and on the day it happened, I was surrounded by deeply funny people, and we were all sort of holding on to each other, and through that, still laughing and making jokes, and it is a great thing to be able to rely on that and fall into that during extraordinary times like this. So yeah, I feel lucky that that's my day to day. And I've leaned on it a lot of times in my life.
I imagine it's also probably your default. Is that kind of how the lens through which you see the world is sort of, you know, how can I put a little bit of levity in the situation?
I think so. I think like most like comedians, comics in general, I think there's a gallows humor always. And I think, I think that there's a certain tendency to make light of the dark. Yeah, always.
Yeah. It's always interesting to me that duality of comics, because I know a lot of comedians, and I'm not saying you here, but I know a lot of comedians that suffer from depression and you know, there's always the double-edged sword of comedy. And I always think that's really interesting, which came out a lot in this book too. So that's, it's kind of the great part of humor is dragging in the tragic side of life and making light of it. So we can get into a lot of that too. We have the luxury of time this morning, so I would love to kind of hear about your path into screenwriting, and it kind of, you know, for listeners out there who might be going that route, if that path has changed probably since you started doing it, but kind of how you got your start as a writer and what that might look like today if people were trying to do that.
Well, my path into screenwriting was a very sort of happy accident, lucky as can be, because I started out as an actor when I was a kid, really. When I was about 13 years old, I was acting in commercials and community theater. And really, I thought, well, I'm done now. I know exactly what I want to do for the rest of my life. I don't need to prepare myself to do anything else. I didn't go to college. I didn't learn how to do anything else. I barely went to high school because I was acting professionally already. So I really did not set myself up very well, other than I excelled in my typing class in high school. So, I mean, thank God for that, honestly. But I did okay as an actor. I made a living at it. And I thought, you know, this will continue for the rest of my life, and until it didn't. And that all sort of dried up when I hit 30, and I had nothing else to fall back on. And this is the dumbest story ever. And so, you know, anybody who's listening and hoping for a path is unfortunately not going to get one. But I do have other ideas for a path. I went to a psychic. And the psychic held onto my keychain and said, and got the vibrations from my keychain and said, well, if you act, you'll be moderately successful. But if you write, you'll be successful beyond your wildest dreams. I was like, oh, no, that seems so hard. I don't want to write that. I have no idea how to write. I don't know what to do. But I was dead broke. I had sold everything that I had bought from money acting, and I was working at a t-shirt factory. I was really sort of in dire straits. So I was earning 50 cents a page typing for my friend who wrote screenplays, because I was a good typist. And I wrote a play, and just sort of autobiographical, didn't know what it was or if I knew how to write it all. And I showed it to this friend of mine, and he liked it, and he produced it and put it up in a theater and invited all of his showbiz friends. And I invited everybody I knew. And I starred in it because I still was hoping to get acting jobs, not anything else. I didn't get a single acting job from it, but I did get an agent from there, and it started my writing career, reluctantly. And, you know, it was very lucky, and through, you know, the kindness of other people. And then I had to really start working at it. I mean, things didn't happen quite as, you know, easily after that. Then I had to really sit down and learn about what I was doing. And my first staff job was on a show called Weird Science, which was completely not in my wheelhouse. It was not subject matter that appealed to me. And that was really how I learned to be a writer, because it was writing something that I didn't know and I didn't connect to. And that was sort of, you know, that was the best job I could have had, because it was writing on assignment, deadlines, mm-hmm. and writing things that didn't necessarily inspire me. And that was a great way to learn how to be a real writer, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was really on the job trial by fire training.
Very much so. Yeah. And yeah. I still No, I mean, it probably took me 10 years to really say out loud to anybody when they said, what do you do, to say, I'm a writer, and feel legitimate about it, because it felt so just that I'd stepped in it a little bit. I feel incredibly grateful that I did.
I think the imposter syndrome is so high in writing.
Yeah.
People really, it takes people, yeah, you're right, years until they confess to it. Wasn't there a psychic in another part of your life? Like, I feel like there was, or was that the story? There was an essay in here about a psychic.
John Edward, the famous psychic who did the show, yes. Crossing Over, where he spoke to, you know, people who had died. I ended up meeting him when my sister died. And he had a big influence, a big part in my life. And in the book, I write about my encounter with him, how we sort of bamboozled him. A friend of mine who is the executive producer on Will and Grace, we kind of tricked him into coming and giving me a reading so that I could talk to my sister who had died.
Right.
And we promised him a guest star on the show if he would come give me a reading. And we didn't really have a guest star for him. We ended up using him though, because he was so nice and so kind and so incredible that we did give him a guest star on the show, as it turned out. And, and it was kind of an extraordinary experience. He was delightful. He was wonderful.
I knew there were more than one psychic in your past.
Yeah.
So yes, great. Before we dive into the book, one last question on the screenwriting. I was wondering how much, because a lot of writers come from various different backgrounds, and some of those backgrounds help when you're sitting down to do a, a book sort of manuscript, and some of them hurt. And I was wondering if the screenwriting discipline was sort of a help to you in doing this book, or if there were parts of it that helped, or if there were parts of it that kind of held you back.
Well, for me, I think because these are essays, and because a lot of them are sort of scenes a little bit, I think they sort of play out as scenes. I think it did help in this circumstance. For me, everything sort of helps. Everything goes into it. It didn't feel like a difficult transition for me writing these essays from screenwriting. I didn't feel like I had to relearn anything. So they felt sort of, it felt like a natural transition for me in this case.
Good. Yeah. You'd mentioned earlier that, that perhaps, you know, going to a psychic wasn't the path that you would recommend people to take, but that you, you did have recommendations. So, you know, are there ways people would go about it these days if that was a path they were going to pursue?
Well, I think, I mean, mostly what I say to people, and I talk to, you know, my kids just graduated college. I one still in college. And so I talk to a lot of their friends, and a lot of them are going to school looking for careers in what I do. And I think the most important thing, and what served me really well, is figuring out your own story. You know, start there. Figure out what is authentic about the story that you have to tell. Because to me, that's what always stands out when I meet young writers, or not young writers, but writers that are starting out, is the specifics of their story and how that comes through in their work. And I think that if you can capture that, that's what's going to be interesting about you. So I think that is my best advice, is to tell your own story. And don't think about the end game. I think it, you know, I talk to a lot of people who tell me, I have this idea that I think will sell to a lot of people, and it's global, and it can be marketed this way, and it can do this. I think that's not your job as a writer, to think about the ad campaign, or to think about the you know, which network it's going to be on, or which streaming platform it's going to be on. I think your job as a writer is to tell the story and then let it find its place. So I think don't be an ad executive, be a writer, is my best advice. So just figure out what your story is, and then tell your story. And I think that's what served me well. And anytime I've gone the other way and sort of put the cart before the horse, or thought about the actor that I want to play it, or thought about, you know, the other things that have nothing to do with the story, I've gotten lost, and it's not actually worked out very well for me.
I'm really glad you said that, because that seems like what distinguishes the screenwriters, script writers that I know from the novelists that I know, which is the screenwriters are always looking for sort of what Hollywood's looking for, and what the angle is, and the end game, as you say. And the novelists are just like, you know, drinking in their closet and trying to get something, trying to squeeze 10 words out, you know.
Yeah.
Without hope or, you know, aspirations.
Yeah, but I think it's a good process. I think that's the right process for screenwriters too. And that's where special things come from, and unique things come from, you know. And there's some really good television. Television is a great medium for writers, for real writers.
Yeah.
I think there's some incredible things being done. And I think it comes from that place of people telling original stories.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The television world has completely transformed in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, but you're right. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the sort of novelistic, you know, once they started doing series and what are they, you know, seasons, yeah. multiple
limited
seasons.
Limited series. Yeah. Right. Like limited series. And it becomes, it's a real writer's medium. It's a great place. And writers, unlike in movies, writers have so much power in television. In movies, the writer is really low man on the totem pole. And in television, the writer is really the top of the food chain. And so that is also good to know if you're a writer. It really is a place to set your sights. I've met kids who have come to me through my kids or whoever, my, you know, parents at school or something, and they come to me and say, I don't want to do television. You know, they have this sort of snooty attitude. It's like, well, you're missing the boat then, because that really is what that's the place to be if you're if you're a writer, a screenwriter anyway, I think.
Right.
That's been my experience. Yeah.
Right. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Carrie Leiser. The book we are just about to embark on is Aren't You Forgetting Someone? Essays from My Midlife Revenge. So let's dive in. I'm going to let you sort of introduce the kind of the scope of the book and where these essays started and kind of how they came about. And then we can dive into to talking about them.
Well, I took a small hiatus from my television writing. I felt like I was sort of churning out some of the same things over and over. I'd been under contract to Warner Brothers for about 10 years. My third child just went off to college, so I had an empty household. And I thought, oh, this is a good time to sort of take a break and regroup and figure out what I want to do next creatively. Which was a terrible idea, as it turned out, because it meant I had no structure to my life. I didn't have an office to go to. There was nobody at home but me. I'm a single mom. It was myself and my dogs, basically, and me talking to myself. And I'm a person who needs a place to go and some structure in my life. And I just sort of wandered around and lost my mind a little bit. And my identity as a person with a job, as a person with kids to get out of the house and people to nag and, you know, pushing boulders up hills, trying to get them into college. And, you know, just all of that, everything that I woke up in the morning for was suddenly gone. And so I joined this writer's group that was recommended by a friend, this woman, Claudette Sutherland, who's this fantastic woman in Los Angeles that people sit around her table and they work on their novels and their essays and their whatever they're working on. And just really for a place to go. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And I thought, well, maybe I'll write a play. Maybe that will take me out of myself a little bit here. And I started and wasn't really working. And I just started writing these sort of rants. I was kind of mad at my kids for leaving me. I was mad at my parents for getting old. I was mad at show business. It was the beginning of the sort of Me Too movement. Trump had just been elected. I was sort of just in a terrible mood. And I started writing these rants and I would bring them to the table and people would laugh. And I love to get a laugh. So I kept writing them. And they turned into this pile of essays of things. I didn't really know what they were. I'll say it again. I didn't really have an end in mind. I was enjoying this new form that I was writing in. I'm a big fan of essays. I'm a huge fan of David Sedaris, for instance. I could, you know, read him all day long. And I just changed agents and they sort of were getting a little bit impatient with my wandering around, not doing anything. And, they called me in for a meeting and they said, bring us whatever you're thinking about, whatever you're working on. And so I walk into this conference room of these, you know, suited men, almost exclusively men. I think there was one woman in there. And I basically bring in, you know, this plate with my uterus on it of these, you know, rants and ravings about how unfair the world is and women are treated horribly and what's going to happen and the men are destroying the earth and my kids left me. And, you know, I mean, just a raving lunatic. And I thought they're going to either let me go, you know, say we've made a terrible mistake in signing you or not, or whatever. I didn't really care. So I brought them these essays and I said, here is really where my heart is these days. I don't really feel like writing a TV pilot right now. I'm doing this and I feel passionate about it. And I dumped these things in their lap. And to their credit, they responded to them and they said, well, let's see what we can do. And I was afraid they were going to say, oh, let's turn it into a TV show. But they didn't. And they said, we think it is a book and but we don't do books. So let's see if our literary department in New York, you know, has anything to say about it. And it was a process. It was a long process of refining, adding essays, making sure that there was somewhat of a narrative in it, because it was just sort of a loose collection. And then I really had to really sit down and go to work on it and sort of figure out a shape and that kind of thing. But it was just initially just a creative burst and a rage burst more than anything else. and then it became this thing that was ultimately really satisfying, because it was also just me for the most part. And television is such a collaborative affair. There's so many cooks in that kitchen, you know, there's so many executives on board. There's so many people giving you thoughts and notes and all of that, that in that way, it was just me alone with my thoughts. And so that part was just fantastic.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned David Sedaris, because I'm also a huge fan. And several times when I was reading your book, I thought, if David Sedaris was a straight middle-aged woman instead of a gay middle-aged man, this is what he would write. This is
oh, well, that's a huge compliment. Thank you.
Well, and it's funny because when I read him a couple of years ago, and, you know, I was just also playing around with form, and I thought, oh, this is, you know, this would be fun and easy. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. And, you know, humor, I think, can come across as really deceptively easy to write. And, you know, you can say to yourself, well, this funny thing happened to me, and write it down. And that does not an essay make, you know, it's, you know, an anecdote is not an essay. So, it's hard. It's really hard. And I don't know if you can, I mean, I don't think you can teach humor. I think that's just your voice. And I don't know how much you work on your voice, or, I mean, it sounds like this is just bubbles up out of you, and you don't have to work on that part of it very much.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I definitely am very, meticulous. I rewrite, you know, I'd still be rewriting this thing if it were up to me. I mean, I rewrite every word and every period and every letter. Because humor is so precise. Comedy is so, so precise that there are still things that bump me, you know, one word off, I think, ruins the thought and the notion and the rhythm. I feel like it's like music, much more than anything else. So, I do think it's very hard to teach. I think people either have an ear for it or they don't. It is incredibly hard work. And I think that, you know, even a 3-page essay, I can work on it for 2 months. I mean, I can keep writing and rewriting and rewriting for a very, very long time. Nothing ever leaves my computer and I say, well, that's great. that's never happened to me ever. So, it is a very precise, for me, a very precise business. And I imagine for most. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think I heard Sedaris say every essay, you know, is rewritten about 75 times before, you know, before he starts revising it. So it's,
yeah, you can tell it's
super tight. Yeah. And it's funny how humor gives a much more deceptive feel than, you know, literary fiction often feels like it's been, you know, overwrought and rewritten. And humor, when you get it right, it just feels like that's just how it, you know, plopped out of your computer. Yeah. So really well done. It's interesting. I was just listening to Malcolm Gladwell's, he's got this revisionist history podcast, and he was talking about how much satire and humor can do in the time of politics that straight essay writing about things can't do. You know, that humor can push you a little bit further, and it can make a commentary a little bit more cutting because there's, you know, because there's humor in it. And, I thought, you know, there's a little bit of politics in here, but the lens is mostly directed at you and your family, and how you can really make some pretty cutting, hard observations that if it wasn't funny, would be, you know, maybe hard for the hard for you to take, or hard for the subject to take. And also, you know, just what a gift and skill that is. And it's just the latitude of humor, I guess, is what I was trying to point out here, that it can do things other things can't.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it does I think it helps us talk about things. I think that's true. It helps us talk about things that are otherwise hard to talk about, and helps us hear things that are otherwise hard to hear.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the generation of story ideas. So when you were sitting down to do a rant, something would, I just kind of want to walk through your process here. Something would pop into your head that perhaps happened to you that sticks out. And then it would kind of talk about your point of entry into a lot of these, and then working through whatever that point of entry was to, you know, to make it, shape it into kind of an essay. I know that's a broad question, but.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they were dead ends. You know, sometimes I would think, oh, this is great. You know, there would be something that was, I mean, I'll take one that had sort of a relevant, sort of a newsy feel. There's an essay called Kate Middleton's Bangs. Mm. And there was a thing on AOL that kept talking about Kate Middleton had her haircut. And it like stuck in my craw. Kate Middleton's haircut. I was like, why? And it just was one of those days when I was so cranky that this woman who was bright and accomplished and all these things, and all they could talk about was her hair. And my daughter, Annabelle, went to the same university that Kate Middleton and Prince William went to in St. Andrews. And it was just bothering me to no end that across the board, all they were talking about with these women was their skin and their hair and what clothes they wore and what they did. And so I think initially when I tried to write that essay, I just tried to straight up rant about that. Just a sort of a political feminist, I've had it and this is what happens, and write about that. And what I realized was nobody cares what I think about that. And you know, it's not funny, it's not interesting, it's just sort of too on the nose. And so I realized with all of these essays, oh no, I have to tell the funny, I have to find the story that is my story. Mm. Why does Kate Middleton's picture on AOL break my heart? Mm-hmm. You know, why does it wound me? Why am I so wounded by dumb Kate Middleton, who I don't know? I will never know her. I'm sure she's fine, by the way. So why am I so undone by it? What is it? What's going on with me? And so a lot of times, and it would sometimes take me weeks to make a connection, and it's trial and error. And it's like, is it about aging? You know what I mean? Is it about me aging, and am I, you know, and I would sort of go down the road of like, that it hurts my feelings because I don't want to be judged on the basis of my looks. And do I need to tell a story about aging actresses and me seeing actresses aging in Hollywood as I cast actors in my pilots and things? And I really, and what I tended to do in these essays was take layers of skin off. You know what I mean? And when I felt myself getting preachy or telling people what to think or just having an opinion, going back and just diving a little bit deeper and just telling the truth about myself, like just getting a little bit more self-deprecating as opposed to telling people what I think about something. And that was sort of the process, if that makes any sense at all. And so then, and what happened was then these stories just became about the world hurts my feelings. So,
right.
But, and here's why, and maybe, and then maybe you can relate to it because I work in Hollywood and I, you know, and this is what happens, and telling stories about circumstances that not everybody gets to experience, that I'm casting these actresses who are objectively beautiful, and I have to sit in a room with these sort of grotesque producer types who, as soon as that objectively beautiful woman walks out of the room, they start assessing her body parts as she walks out of the room, and that I am subject to this, and I feel complicit, and I feel wounded, and I feel like I want to crawl into a sleeping bag and stay there and, you know, go to Vermont for the rest of my life and get out of Hollywood. So but I have to tell the stories in a way that let you know that I'm not just casting, I'm not just judging it. I'm how it feels to live it, to live in that story. And it's tricky. Yeah.
It's tricky. Yeah. It's interesting that the observation that I was going to make about a lot of these essays, and I think we're getting at the same thing from two different angles, is it always felt like you were connecting one thing to another thing to make it a bigger third thing. Like in that essay, there's this really funny part about you going in for a non-surgical facelift, and this doctor's like pressuring you into doing this, and she's like some Iranian refugee who has, and she's comparing her, you know, painful bullets whizzing past her past to, you know, what a not
what
a big deal.
Baby I was.
What a baby
yeah,
you're being, I, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
and so to, yeah, it's so, but so the, I mean, A, that's so funny, but B, it always felt like you were taking kind of two disparate ideas, marrying them together and making this kind of bigger statement about something. And it sounds like my sort of A plus B equals, you know, F equation is probably not kind of the way these essays came about, but it's more a process of excavation. And here's an idea and let me explore why it's a big idea, and let me explore why this, you know, this AOL article is wounding to me. So that's interesting. And I guess in the process of that excavation is when you come up with these, oh, now this memory of this Iranian Botox woman is entering my brain, and maybe that connects to this.
Right. And it was always, I mean, the agenda became reveal more, like dig deeper, reveal more. And it became sort of the mantra even around the table with the other writers of, and we say it a lot, Claudette says it a lot, and the other writers that I'm in a group with, of, I want more you in that piece. You know what I mean? Where if anybody tends to write, I do it, everybody does it, from this sort of head place, you know, the neck up. I'm being very smart right now, and I'm writing about the politics and the way the world is and things. And it just, it can leave a person cold, you know, and it's like now, and then when you write from a place of, I'm going to put myself in this piece now and reveal something about myself, and it's going to, and I'm going to embarrass myself. And then you maybe have something, you know, not, you know, don't be afraid to look stupid, you know what I mean? To really reveal something. You know, there are people who have read this book who are like, wow, I sure know a lot about you now. Like, oh, well, yeah, you do. And there was a moment, you know, when, cause I've just been sort of writing it, you know, for myself and with myself, the small group of intimate people that I know and love and trust. And then suddenly when the idea became, it's like, oh, wait, now it's going to go out into the world.
Right.
And it doesn't really occur to you when you're writing, you know, drinking in your closet, like you said, you know, that it's like, oh, what's in there exactly? What did I write?
Right.
You know, especially when they're, you know, autobiographical essays. It does take a minute to adjust to that idea of putting such personal things out into the world, but you know, why not? You know, at a certain point you just have to sort of get brave about it.
How many times is my uterus on the page? Yeah.
That's right. Right. So many times.
Well, that, I mean, that's a good point. First of all, I think self kind of implication or self reveal. I mean, that's what essays, that's the that's the breath behind essays, right? Is it, mm-hmm. That's what it kind of is. But it was never, it never felt like it was like a gratuitous revealing of here's some salacious personal detail about me that I right. just think you're going to be interested in. I mean, it always, you know, it has to serve a purpose, right? And so, and that's what makes them so relatable is, you know, I thought I was the only one who had, you know, saline injected into my uterus, but look, everybody. So,
oh, good.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the humanness of essays is why people turn to essays, right? Because they feel seen, and the more specific it is, the more general it becomes, right? So,
well, that's the hope, because there are those moments of fear for me anyway, or self-consciousness, I guess, not fear, self-consciousness, where it's like, am I just writing a journal here? And who cares? Who cares about my dumb story about saline in my uterus, you know? And so then you hope that it's, you're writing it so that people do feel seen, and like that you're actually writing something that people feel your humanity, and that you're sort of saying, hey, we're sort of all in this together. I mean, I think that's why I like comedy. That's why what television sort of does, it's a big sort of, you know, familial thing. So I had to get over a lot of that, of like, you know, who cares about my dumb stories? You know, because there is a self-consciousness that goes along with it.
Yeah. You're tuned into Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm talking with Carrie Leiser about her book, Aren't You Forgetting Someone? Essays from My Midlife Revenge. To that point, were there subject matters that you felt were off limits, or, you know, places that you didn't want to go either for, and you don't have to tell me, I mean, you don't have to reveal what those were, obviously, but either for yourself or for other people in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mind telling you what they were. I mean, I won't go into detail why do it now and then not put it in the book. But I mean, I, you know, it was important to me to protect my children on a certain level. My, you know, my kids, I did say, listen, this book has a lot to do with you. And I would send them some essays and say, is this okay? They're very good sports, my kids. They like the attention, frankly. Yeah. But for instance, I didn't go a lot into my divorce. I didn't, that didn't feel like necessary territory to go into. You know, their dad, I have a fine relationship with him, and, you know, that just didn't feel like anything that needed to be dredged up. I did talk about, I lost a brother and a sister. And I do talk about that. Not a ton of detail other than saying that happened and it affected me. Mostly what I try to do, what I tried to do, because I was aware that there are some difficult things, is I tried to put it through sort of the prism of my experience, of not talk about other people, but just say, this is my experience. This is my part of the story, and not tell other people's stories for them. Mm-hmm. Which I think was the way that I tried to manage that. Because you know, everybody has their story, and everybody's story is remarkably different of the same event, is what I found throughout my life. So, yeah, I try to be careful. There's still some things that are sensitive and that were delicate, and that they're definitely tricky parts, but I feel pretty clean about it. But there were definitely areas that I tiptoed around, for sure.
Well, you answered one of my other questions, which is whether you felt like you had to sort of vet some of these with the people involved. And I guess your kids would be different than, you know, vetting it with Alan Thicke or something, but, you know, it's,
yeah, I didn't die. I felt okay about that. Yeah.
I was also curious about, well, actually, something you said before also struck me as, you know, that's just kind of good therapy. Like, if you were to go into marriage counseling, that's what they would say, is tell your own story, you know, tell how you see events, and your story is your story, and the way somebody else would see them is another way. I just think that's, you know, kind of a healthy way of approaching the world. And I hadn't really applied that to writing, but you're right. I mean, that's, that's probably a good rule to follow, that you're kind of on safe ground when it's your story you're telling,
other actors may pop up, but you know, it's the lens through which you processed whatever happened to you that is the important bits. So yeah, that's,
and it can still, it can still be problematic, and there are areas where it's a little sensitive, but I think that I just think you have to have good intentions and not be intentionally hurtful. That's always the rule of thumb, right? So, when you're telling stories, it's always an interesting phenomenon. I'm sure it will happen with my kids, that kids and parents certainly remember events of childhood and parenting differently. It is just a fact of life. I'm sure I will have to hear stories of my kids will tell their kids stories about me and I'll be like, that didn't happen. But, and that will be great revenge. And so that is just the nature of things. So
right.
Just try to be careful and as kind as possible.
Right. I do this a lot with short story writers, and I thought it would be fun for me. I don't know if it'll be fun for you, but fun for us to walk through a couple of these, maybe an essay that gave you the most difficulty, that was kind of the one that you churned through the hardest, or maybe an essay that started out as something and totally surprised you and became something you didn't anticipate. But, you know, for people trying to sit down and write essays, I thought we could use one of these as a template to kind of walk through the process of initial kernel of an idea to kind of how you worked through it and revised it. We did that a little bit with Kate Middleton, but is there another one or two in here that kind of stand out in your head as particularly problematic or satisfying that we could highlight?
Just as a general process and not necessarily a specific essay, once I sold the essays as a book to Running Press and started working with an editor, and this is obviously sort of late in the process, but this is one thing that sort of occurs to me, that my editor, Jennifer Cassius, who was wonderful and kind and really, I felt like she really got it and got the material. But she, one of her notes and thoughts is that she felt like there were sort of holes in the narrative a little bit, where there were places to sort of fill in the blanks. And she wanted a higher page count. And so up until that moment, I had just been freewheeling, writing as the spirit moved me, more or less, and, you know, just putting them together however they came to me. So suddenly this thing, I was sort of now writing on assignment a little bit. She didn't tell me what to write or the subject matter or anything else, but she just sort of gave me a little bit of direction, and it completely stopped me in my tracks. First of all, you know, I need this many more pages, so I'm a little bit late, or this many more words rather, and just, you know, fill it in here. And so I went cold. I mean, I couldn't write a word. I was really I sat staring at these essays like, well, I don't think there's anything more to say. I mean, I'm staring at it just like, I don't know. There, nothing organic. I for, you know, a couple of months, I was really like, I can't think of anything organic. And I would try to sit down. I would go to my writer's group and I would bring in these pieces that just felt like what they were, which was me trying to recapture what had spurred these essays in the first place, which was just sort of these sparks of ideas. And these were not being sparked. These were homework assignments. And it took me, you know, truly a couple of months to sort of shake that off and say, just write a bad one. And then you can rewrite it. And then you can do it all over again and stop thinking about it as an assignment and that it has to be something. And so those ended up being the first essay and the last essay, because I needed more or less an intro and an ending.
Yep.
And which makes sense. And I need to sort of introduce the idea of where I was when I started this. And, you know, and so they needed to contain a lot of thoughts and a lot of, you know, well, here I am, and this is who I am, and this is what's happening and where we are in the world and all of those kind of things, and be funny and feel like it's organic and not me just setting the stage for something. So that was really hard, that first one. And I had to really come up with a story and an anecdote that did that accomplished all of those things. So that, I think, was the hardest one.
I was going to ask you if, I was actually going to ask you if the first one was the last one written, because it, I mean, it did feel like it had to be sort of an introductory piece to the full collection, and it was. So yeah, that it would make sense that it came at the end.
Yeah, it was. And it was very, very difficult because it felt like it had to accomplish so much.
Yeah.
So there was that one. And then other than that, I sort of dropped in a couple more that sort of played with the timeline a little bit, like, because it happened, these essays came together over the span of a couple of years, and my kids and the ones that were about my kids, a lot happens in a couple of years with kids that are in their early 20s. They go to college and then they actually graduate from college. So they, you know, things had changed. My son Elias had come home from college in the meantime. And so there was another essay that sort of touched on the idea of, oh, you know, all this pulling at my, you know, my nightgown over him leaving me, and then he's back, and the feelings had completely shifted of like, what are you doing here? You know, because I had adjusted to this idea of my happy home. It was so clean and quiet. And then suddenly he was back and you know, disturbing the peace. But so it was a little bit like, and how does this fit in? And it became a puzzle, and it became a thing, but a good, you know, good for my brain probably. It's complicated, but it gets complicated when another person comes in and sort of objectively looks at it and says, this is what I'm seeing. Really good for me, because you're so inside it for so long, obviously, and because they're personal, and because it's, you know, real and memoir and all of that kind of stuff, that it's fantastic to have just a completely objective person who doesn't know you, who doesn't know your kids, who doesn't know the stories, to come and say, this is what I'm taking away from it. So I think that's a great part of the process, even though it's a really difficult part of the process.
Yeah. Well, and the ordering of the collection is really complicated. I mean, it struck me as I went back after it was done and kind of looked at how you pieced it together. It's not chronological. It's not even really thematic. And yet it feels really right. And so I thought she must have sat down at a dining room table for a year trying to figure
yeah.
out.
Yeah, and second guess that too, you know, and thought now, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of second guessing and then ultimate. Yeah, for whatever reason, I don't really even know why that felt right, but it did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to your earlier point about comedy being so much about rhythm and more like music than anything else, I think that's how short story and essay collections feel as well, you know, that each one has to be a particular movement of a piece, but then, you know, it has to create kind of this symphony and, you know, you need a little more tambourine here and a little less cowbell there.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's really how it felt. So it's, and maybe that's just something you have to intuit more than intellectualize. I don't know, but
I think so. I think for me, I think with this in particular, and probably with most, it has to come down less to timeline than about mood of those pieces, and know when you have to lighten up and you have to throw in one that's fluffier because you've just really gone down some kind of a darker rabbit hole and you've sort of taken somebody through something, and then it's like let's give them a little candy now and before we go back down that road again. So that it definitely, that was the process more than do we care that they just graduated or they just started college and now one of them's out. But also, you know, but certainly you have to do the logic thing too of we haven't introduced this person yet, now we're talking about this person as if we are old friends.
Oh,
so
right.
you have to do that thing too. But so there's a couple things at play, but the mood thing, you know, the shape is I think most important.
Right. There's so many great parts of these essays where you have like the essay where your son moves back home and you're trying to get him to restain the deck or something.
Yes.
And the deck just becomes this really great metaphor for this is how I would do it. And you're, you know, now you're just staining in cat hair and dirt into it without sweeping it and power washing it. But isn't that a great metaphor for parenting and relationships and marriage? And, you know, I would mm-hmm. clean the decks and you would just, you know, stick all the damn cat hair in there. And so many, and, you know, I imagine these things are kind of subconscious when you're writing them out and that's just how it happened, but they also become really great metaphors for relationships and how things work. And, you know, maybe that's just the beauty of how writing comes about is, you know, you look back at it and say, wow, that was a really fortuitous, you know, statement.
Yeah, well, that's my favorite part of writing is you're sort of going along and then these things reveal themselves as more than what they started out to be, you know, that yeah. it's a story about being frustrated with your kid because he's not meticulous and careful and you're worried about them out in the world when it's just about painting a deck and it's not about them, you know, getting into a drunken driving accident. And it suddenly becomes about that. And it's, you know, and it opens itself up to that. That is just, there's no better feeling, I don't think, than when you're writing and it becomes something else. It transforms into something deeper than it started out as. I think that's the greatest feeling.
Indeed.
Pure frustration to that.
Right. And I assume that all happens sort of in the revision,
mm-hmm.
revision process. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you a woman who walks around the world with a notebook or kind of how do you live in the world as a writer? Are you always kind of eavesdropping on people's conversations? And
yes, I am. I have 1,000 notebooks at all times. I'm always in search of the perfect notebook. I love them and Uniball pens. Yeah, I scribble everywhere, on everything. And, you know, I have pieces of paper, you know, and I go through periods of fertility and barrenness, you know, I'm,
right.
And it's sort of, you know, like a lot of people, I'm mostly fertile when I don't have time to be. Mm. I'm starting up a new TV show right now. And so all I want to do is write more essays. And when I had, you know, during this pandemic and this lockdown, like, oh, isn't this perfect? I could write another book. So I've written not word one, but,
right.
You know, as that seems to be the way it goes. And now that I'm prepping this show, and in the writer's room for that on Zoom writer's room, there's not a minute to spare to do anything else. And so I keep having these just germs of thoughts of what the next chapters of this thing will be. So that's yeah. sort of the way it always seems to go.
Do you think the kind of new state of the world with the pandemic and Zoom is going to change how the writers collaborate? Did your writing group move online and things like that? And how is that?
Yeah, the writing group did move online, and I'm doing this writer's room. Well, I'm in Vermont, and they're all for the most part in Los Angeles. I don't think it will. I don't. We've only been doing it for 2 weeks, this writer's room, and our writer's group, the ones, our fiction and, you know, the regular writer's group has been doing it online. It does not replace the humanity of sitting around a table together. It just doesn't. I don't think it ever will. We really miss something there. Mm. And I don't think, I mean, we can do it. It's getting done. It's not that the work is bad, but I think that it just is not, the connection is just not there. I mean, I've said to the writers on the television show, that I think when I get back into town, even if we have to sit out in a park 10 feet apart and yell at each other with the writer's assistant sitting in the middle of the circle in some weird, you know, witch's circle. I don't know what that's going to look like, but whatever we have to do, I feel like we need to be able to interrupt each other and laugh with each other. You know, it's a little bit polite now. It's a little bit, like, oh, I'm sorry. No, were you talking? It's just, there is definitely something lost, and not that we can't adjust to it. It just doesn't feel the same. I want to be able to walk into the kitchen with somebody and, you know, have a sidebar conversation and an idea that sparks when we, you know, walk to the bathroom together. I don't know. I mean, there's just something about bodies together that is different than this.
That said, I think this whole period is going to spawn a lot of creativity and, you know, weird art is going to come out of this whole thing. But
yes, agreed. It's not all bad. That's for sure. It's not all bad. And I think people's brains are working, so that's good. But I do think that you can't replace human connection.
Right. Right. Would you say that you kind of came out of this book kind of a different person than you went into it? Like, did the essays reveal something to you? I don't think people write for therapy, and it doesn't sound like that's really, I mean, maybe you wrote just to scream at the world a little bit, but do you kind of feel changed as a writer having come through this and seeing yourself a little clearer, or is that really not the role of essays?
I think I gained a lot of confidence as a writer from doing these. I think that I did sort of find my voice a little bit more than I would have if I hadn't done it, because as a television writer predominantly, I do have to write for other people. I have to always get notes and run it through the factory, you know. I mean, everybody's right. always getting to tell me, you know, no, change that, don't do that. And although I have some autonomy because I've been doing it for a long time, I still have to listen to what everybody thinks of me, you know, constantly, right. which I hate. So this gave me the, you know, it's nice to be able to just write it. And, you know, this is exactly how I would do it, for better or worse. This is how I would write it. This is my version of it completely. Yeah. So in that way, it really, that is my voice, for better or worse. And that's nice, you know, at 58 years old, to sort of speak in my own unfiltered voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we covered a lot of ground. Are there things we should have talked about, advice that you have that we didn't get out there?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, other than that last thing that I said is sort of, you know, trust your own voice, which I think is what I did learn from this. And I just, you know, that continues to sort of get reinforced for me. Whenever I do that, things tend to go well. So that's what I would say to anybody who's trying to do this, because it's hard, you know.
Right, right, right. And, yeah. Tell us where we can find you. You don't have a website that I could find.
I don't have a website, but I do have an author, a Facebook page, just Carrie Leiser, the book is sort of everywhere. You can go to Running Press and find out where to get it. And
the book is everywhere. It's so great. It's so great. Carrie Leiser, thank you so much for taking the time. This was really great.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I had a good time.
Me too. That's all the time we have for today, but we will be right back with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.